File 2925 is back in order. And Mr. Orpert, we cut you off. So do you remember where you left off?
I do, Representative Blush. Thank you, sir. And I'll keep my remarks very brief. As I think I was saying is that we appreciated the work that's gone into this bill. We don't quibble with it. We actually support it. And we appreciate that you are open to considering. What I'm here to ask is for the clear and convincing standard on behalf of victims of crime. Very difficult and very emotional when these issues come up and they think somehow that somebody's going to be exonerated for reasons where typically the way I've seen these happen, not in a couple of the poignant cases, but in others where witnesses change testimony and those kinds of things happen, and it becomes very difficult for victims. And if we could tell them that the standard is clear and convincing, which would be consistent with states like Maine, New Jersey, New York, District of Columbia, Wisconsin, and Iowa, that would go well toward assuaging any fears and concerns they have. However, I might suggest, if I might, that we could keep the preponderance part a standard in for DNA evidence. So if there's DNA, that could be, in trying to find a compromise with my colleagues from the Innocence Project, I would ask that clear and convincing otherwise, but when it comes to DNA, the preponderance. That's what I would like to suggest. And again, I would simply say this, that I would like to be able to offer the crime victims with whom we meet frequently that that clear and convincing standard would be most meaningful for them. And that's all I really have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Orpert. Is there questions? Are there questions of members for Mr. Orpert? Seeing none, then thank you. Any other testifiers in favor? Let's do this. Any other testifiers in favor of the purported House position? That's how I'm going to slice this. The purported House position and the language. Oh, actually, I should clarify one thing. Is it your understanding that there is agreement on most of the language, with the exception of the clearing the standard of proof? Yes. Mr. Choi?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. From my perspective, and you'd have to ask the Innocence Project, so I won't speak for them, but I believe that we do have an agreement with respect to the House language, except for that how to deal with the burden of proof on the petition.
Okay, so I wanted members of the committee to hear that, and we'll have yet to hear from the Innocence Project and folks to see if that's their take as well. If it is, that would probably really cut down on our time here in conference committee, and we could have a discussion on the standard of proof. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committees.
Are there, I see representatives of the Innocence Project here. If you want to come forward and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Julie Jonas, managing attorney with the Innocence Project of Minnesota. First off, I'd really also like to thank the chairs for championing this bill, for helping us to get so far with this important piece of legislation. I also want to thank the conferees that are here today for their votes on the floor and also their votes in conference committee and for allowing us to have this conversation. I do appreciate the thanks that was extended to us from Mr. Choi and Mr. Orput and the acknowledgement of the compromises that we have made in putting this bill together. And I do think that the bill that's before you, the House bill that's before you, with the exception of these three versus four words, represents a lot of compromise on the part of the Innocence Project. And so I do want to voice my strong belief and hope that this conference committee will support a preponderance standard for this bill. We have, even today, as we've been meeting and waiting for this to occur, there is some additional language that the county attorneys and our organization does agree on, just some minor changes. I don't know if the committee wants me to go through that line by line or if there's just an acknowledgement between us, then we can share it later.
Well, Ms. Jonas, I think that's fair to me. There is obviously the question that there may be an agreement between the Innocence Project and the county attorneys and law enforcement on most of this, but I don't know if any single member of this committee would have their own personal objection to it for one reason or another. So I agree with you. Let's hold off till later, but members, just so you know, that will be talked about later. So if you do have an issue, please bring it up at that time. So go ahead, Mr. Representative Scott, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did the county attorneys, I guess I maybe should have asked them this when they were at the table, but is this a new development for them, or has this been a problem for them since the inception of the bill?
When you say this.
The two differences between the Senate and the House when it comes to which standard of evidence to use.
So what I will tell you is this, and I'm just going to give you my answer since the county attorney is no longer up here, that this has been an issue with them from the beginning. The county attorneys had objected to the earliest language of the bill for various multiple reasons, and actually, say what you will about the reasonableness of their position, they have come quite a ways from their initial objections. But this has, from the beginning, just been one of their major objections. But the standard itself, clear and convincing versus proponents, remains the major objection that they have outstanding, aside from the agreements that they were able to reach with the Innocence Project, and have really come a long way in that discussion. So does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Jonas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that's missing from this discussion is that once one of my clients or anyone is exonerated, when the conviction is vacated by the court, and then the county attorney either decides to dismiss the charges for whatever reasons, or they have a new trial and they're acquitted at trial, in either of those situations, they are no longer guilty of a crime. They are entitled to the same presumption of innocence that we all are entitled to. Once the conviction has been vacated and there is no longer a charge pending, whether it's through the acquittal process at trial or the county attorney's own decision, they are presumed innocent. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when thinking about this bill and when thinking about the standard. You know, we hear the county attorney speak quite a lot about victims, and I understand that. At the Innocence Project, one of the things that we're very happy about is that very oftentimes the true perpetrator is actually caught, particularly in the DNA cases, but in other cases as well. But our exonerees have been victimized as well. They've been victimized in a different way from the victims of crime, but they have spent years in prison and had their lives taken away from them. They are also victims in this situation. As was mentioned, this bill has already been through 7 different policy and finance committees. In all of those committees, we had bipartisan, unanimous support. And although the county attorneys, it's true, may not have approved of the bill, they never came forward and said, oh, but we want this different standard. At least that we never heard that from them. So what it appears to me that they're trying to do now is substitute their judgment for the judgment of dozens of legislators who have already heard this and already approved this bill with the preponderance standard. To me, it seems a little late in the game. This is the preponderance standard is the equivalent standard that the judge uses when vacating the conviction. The judge hears the new evidence of innocence, and then the district court judge, vacates the conviction based on a reasonable probability that the defendant would have been acquitted at trial. Now, I know Ms. Long mentioned that there's a 2-year standard. It's sort of a statute of limitations for seeking relief in the courts, that there is a clear and convincing standard within the statute, and that is true. However, that's just for a hearing. In order to get a new trial, the Supreme Court just affirmed within the last 2 months in the case State v. Miles that the standard for granting a new trial is simply a reasonable probability. That equates to the civil standard of preponderance of the evidence, and that's what we're asking for in this statute. That's also the standard for civil relief, for a civil case, and that's essentially what these cases are. These are no longer criminal cases. when an exoneree comes before the court asking for eligibility and then requesting damages, this is a civil remedy. Frankly, post-conviction relief itself is considered to a large extent a civil remedy, and within the post-conviction statute, the court is only required to look at the evidence from a preponderance standard. So this is the correct standard. I should say, in talking to the county attorneys or representatives from the county attorneys about different negotiations, when we talked about the fact that the county attorneys should have the power to stipulate to some sort of eligibility so that there wouldn't be any need to go into court for a further hearing. It's a wonderful compromise, I think, for us to be able to join with them or whoever's representing the exoneree for the exoneree and the county attorney in an effort to provide a resolution in the interest of justice, that everyone should be able to agree on that. But part of that settlement, to encourage that settlement, is to have this lower standard. If you have a higher standard of clear and convincing evidence, what reason necessarily would the county attorneys have to reach this resolution, right? If you have a lower standard, there's more likelihood of resolving this. Finally, I would just say...
Go ahead, Mr. Cross.
I'm going to wrap up really quick. That my concern is if you have a higher standard, okay, so you go to the clear and convincing standard, an exoneree will have secured their release based on this standard of reasonable probability. They will have... the court will have heard that and determined that, and the exoneree will have secured their liberty on the lower standard, but we're setting a higher standard for them to get the money, that the money would require a higher standard than their freedom and would require yet another hearing on the case. If they're released on reasonable probability, the county attorney decides to dismiss the case or they win an acquittal at trial. Now they're going to have to go back in on a higher standard of clear and convincing evidence and present additional evidence of their innocence. Not only would I say that's not a good thing for the classical victims that the county attorneys are speaking of, but I can tell you for the exonerees, it's devastating. The mental and emotional anguish that accompanies these hearings is brutal. For Mike Hansen, who's here with me, even sitting here today and going through this again is difficult. He's been to trial and lost. He went through a multi-day hearing and won, and now we would have to go back in yet again to prove his innocence again at this higher standard. With the higher standard, that's what we're setting up. As the county attorneys did note, 12 states do use clear and convincing. That's less than half of the states that have this, that's less than half the states that have a compensation statute. The rest of the states either say nothing or have a preponderance statute. I will tell you, Ohio, Mississippi, and Connecticut have a preponderance and no mention of DNA. I would say we don't want to compare ourselves to Iowa and Wisconsin in this way. Wisconsin, the maximum statutory award, no matter how long an exoneree has been in prison, is $25,000. That's it. Do we want to model ourselves after that? Iowa is a little better. So I'd ask that Minnesota take the lead, as it so oftentimes does, and set the appropriate standard that is consistent with the Minnesota law for an exoneree to gain their freedom.
Ms. Jonas, I wonder if you can do this for us. We're looking at the fine details, which we have the benefit of looking at because of all the work that all the people sitting behind you have done and yourself in order to reach a compromise, which is great. That said, I recognize that there may be some people sitting around the table here who need a little bit more of a 10,000-foot view about where it was. So can you lay out a flowchart of where, let's use Mr. Hansen's case, or just as an example, what are the steps under your proposal that Mr. Hansen sitting behind you would have to go through for this, and what would result at each step? And then what are the steps that he would have to go through under the county attorney's proposal, including the standard of clear and convincing? Could you provide for us a picture of those two scenarios?
So we're talking now post-exoneration. So Mr. Hansen has already been, or any exoneree will have already been through a hearing.
Or you can stay here, it's up to you guys.
Will have already been through a hearing where he proved his innocence, with a reasonable probability standard that he would have been acquitted or had a better outcome at trial given the new evidence of innocence. So that's already happened. The judge has vacated the conviction, and either the county attorney has decided to dismiss the case or someone like Mr. Hansen would have gone to trial and won his and gotten an acquittal. Okay? In Mr. Hansen's case, the county attorney decided to dismiss the charges about a month after the judge vacated the conviction. So now, under the statute, an exoneree would have to go before that same district court where they received their where their sentence was vacated and seek essentially what's called, what we're thinking of as a certificate of eligibility. Okay? At that stage, he would file a motion. He has to wait to file that motion until 60 days after the county attorney has vacated the charge or he's won his he's won at trial. Once he files that request for a certificate of eligibility for compensation, the county attorney does have the ability, through the most recent negotiations that we've made, to enter into a binding stipulation. The county attorney decides, we want this person to get the compensation in the interest of justice. And even if they're mad at us and they don't want to agree with us, we're going to have a binding stipulation that we stipulate to eligibility, and there will be no further discussion of this. And that's fine. I can see the benefit of that. If the county attorney decides not to reach that stipulation, then at my standard, okay, so if we stay at the standard that I believe it should be, preponderance of the evidence, it would go back to the district court judge for a potential hearing. At that point, the county attorney has the right to come in and introduce evidence as to why they dismissed the case. And I think that's mainly what their discussion is geared at. The victim would have the right to have input. I think at that stage in the process, there would be very little more for the exoneree to do because the standard is essentially the same as the standard for the release that they use to gain their freedom. With a higher standard, then I do think there would have to be significantly more evidence presented than what was initially presented at that hearing. Mike, for instance, brought in 6 different experts who proved on varying levels that he had not injured his daughter. Would I need to bring in 9 more? I don't know. I would certainly want to bring in enough to prove to that judge that by a clear and convincing standard, he was innocent. So there would certainly be, when the county attorneys say, you know, it would be great for our victims, I don't think it would be great for your victims because there would have to be another hearing because the standard would be higher. Either way, once he got that certificate of eligibility, which again, I think it would make more sense for it to be the same standard that he had to follow to get his freedom. Once he gets that certificate of eligibility, then he still would have to go to the damages panel, and that's where or the damages commission that would be appointed, and it's at that commission then that the specific dollar amounts would be dealt with.
Thank you. Does that answer everyone's questions about really the mechanics of how this works? Are there any other questions from members? Okay. Thank you very much for that, Ms. Jonas, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the side of either position or from the public who wants to be heard about these differences in the bill? Seeing none, then I'd like to have a discussion among members, and if members here could remain available for questions, I'd appreciate it, about questions or proposals about how we move forward with the differences in these standards. But I guess I'd like to begin by getting the low-hanging fruit out of the way. Ms. Pierce, are we in a position to have language that would be proposed as an amendment that would enshrine all the agreed upon issues between the Innocence Project and the county attorneys, except for the standard of evidence?
I haven't seen anything.
Okay. So we are going to need that. But you said we could do it orally. Is that correct? I see. Okay.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, just to remind you, there is some
Ms. Jonas.
Additional agreed-upon language that I've got here, too.
Okay, and you hadn't brought that up yet. Okay, can you state that, what it is now, and maybe submit it in writing, Ms. Jonas?
I can. So going from the past House file, the most current House file, and I can just do a line by line. So at line 2.4, after the word complaint, we would insert the words or indictment.
After plans.
Okay. Line 2.4, after the word complaint or indictment.
Yep, insert or indictment. And on that same line, after the word filed, insert or sought.
After the word filed on line 2.4, insert or sought.
And then on line 2.19, insert the sentence, both the petitioner.
I'm sorry, after what word, Ms. Jonas?
I think it would just start, and I don't have that.
The word exoneration.
Thank you. After the word exoneration at the period, we would insert an additional sentence.
Go ahead.
That would state both the petitioner and the prosecutor the right to present additional evidence.
Both the petitioner and the prosecutor have the right to present additional evidence.
And then on 3.11, after the words admitted, actually, I'm sorry, it would be the first sentence of the first words of 3.12. We would delete subdivision. No, you would delete under on point, sorry, 3.11, delete under, 3.12, delete subdivision 4. Replace that with, and any evidence admitted at a hearing held pursuant to subdivision 4.
Okay.
Line 3.19, subdivision 3 should actually be 3B to include the letter B.
That's in place of 8. You have subdivision. I'm sorry.
So on line 3.19, where it just says subdivision 3, it should actually be 3A.
You said B.
3B. 3B. Sorry, thank you. And on 3.21, last one, subdivision 3 should say 3A.
3A. Now, this is just the new and recent language. Is that correct, Ms. Jonas?
I don't think, right?
Yeah, there is. No, it goes to the hearing. It's the evidence from the hearing that we're talking about. I'm sorry.
So this is just the new and recent language, Ms. Jonas.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. We okay. just talked about that with the county attorney.
Okay, so it does not include the language that was voted on the House floor, but it's not included in the side-by-side because of the ordering and the amendments. Is that correct?
I think the only difference that was in the House floor then, this language was not in the House floor, in the bill that was voted through on the House floor, but I think now the only language difference left is the standard.
Okay, and after, for the House language, after the changes that you just made, the only thing you're disagreeing on at this point is the standard. Can you point out for members of the committee, Ms. Jonas, exactly what line and where that's located?
Yeah.
And what the language would need to be in order to modify it to your preference versus county attorney's preference?
So currently, line 2.12, by a preponderance of the evidence, as it currently is, it's the way we believe it should be. The county attorney would like that to say by a clear and convincing standard.
So with that, then, if I were to, well, short of that, then, I wanted to be in, us be in a position where we were able to move the agreed-upon language before we make that decision, but I don't think, I guess we could move each other section individually, but why don't we just have that discussion now, then among members, and if members have questions for the testifiers here, they'll be available. So questions from members.
So,
Representative Scott.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, what we're doing is discussing the changes that she just laid out, including the change. Or are we discussing it as preponderance, or are we discussing it as by clear and convincing?
Well, so the standard itself, which is the big tamale question here, is certainly my intent that we have a discussion about that. But, of course, any of the other provisions are available to be discussed. Now, they're agreed upon by both sides, but that doesn't mean we can't talk about them. So if you have questions and also want to have that discussion here in committee about those other provisional changes, they're certainly fieldable.
I did have a question.
Senator Letts.
On line 6.7.
Yours or ours?
I'm sorry, the House, on page R5, House language 6.7, 6.10, talks about reintegrative expenses. And I think when that language was developed, at least my recollection, is that there was some belief that the Department of Corrections paid for reintegrative expenses of the nature that's listed here. I have since been informed by the Department of Corrections that really they don't do anything like this. That, you know, they give them, I think it's a cab ride and maybe $100 walk-away money or something like that, and they can get them to the halfway house if they're going to a halfway house. But beyond that, not sure the Department of Corrections does anything else. Maybe we could get some clarification on that point. I know DOC was here in the room earlier.
Is your representative of the Department of Corrections here?
I just don't want to include language in here that is, in fact, not not language that does anything.
Right. Well, I would like the answer to that as well. Senator Latz, so maybe if we get a hold of the department, they can come in here later and give an answer to that.
Mr. Chair, might I address
Ms. Jonas?
Our contemplation was that with that had nothing to do really with the Department of Corrections, but rather the assumption that when most of these men walk out of prison, they have nothing. I mean, at least if they're really guilty and they're leaving on parole, they get $100 gate money, they get a cab to the halfway house, they have access to a halfway house to live in. The guys who come out who are innocent get nothing, and they will have some instant expenses because their house was taken away from them when they were sent to prison, because their apartment was taken away from them, their car was taken away from them. You know, they've been in prison for a number of years. All of those things have been sold or given away. They are going to have some instant expenses that are going to be above the norm that a regular person who had built up a lifetime of savings and who had been working and who was able to do those things would have. That amount contemplated in Section 6, again, would be up to the Damages Committee's discretion. But if they had some instant expenses on relief, like a damage deposit on an apartment or a very inexpensive car, we would like to be able to seek reimbursement for that based on what they lost upon going in. So it really didn't have much to do with the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Well, I'm satisfied with that answer, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I just know at least part of the initial contemplation. I know we talked about this informally in some other context. Well, DOC does some of these things for the people that were convicted and served their time.
No, and if
we thought at least they ought to get this much for those who are exonerated. But I understand the additional basis, regardless of what DOC does for the other group of people. I'm satisfied.
And we do have a representative of the Department of Corrections here, but we in fact got our question answered that didn't require querying Department of Corrections. So, but thank you for being back here for that. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Is there a fiscal note on this bill? And if so, was that included in it? Because somebody's got to pay for that if we keep the language in.
So maybe if I can have staff explain that. It is kind of an ad hoc type of fiscal note, because by the time we have to pay out, we'll know. Ms. Perius, did you want to field that?
Sorry, I'm just stepping in for Mr. Diebel, so I haven't actually seen the fiscal note, but I believe the panel request goes before the legislature for the appropriation, and that's at the end of the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts.
Ms. Pontius has reminded me that an earlier version of the bill had the Department of Corrections providing some of these services to the exonerees as they leave, and that's no longer a part of the bill. So not only does it eliminate some fiscal, a direct fiscal impact in that regard, but it clears up some of the earlier misconception as well.
Thank you for that clarification, Senator Letts and Ms. Pontius. Any other questions for members? I have a question for representative of the county attorneys that is something that I've been struggling with personally on this. We grow up in this country with the understanding and expectation that you're innocent until proven guilty. This was phrased by Ms. Jonas that way. And I'm having some difficulty to the idea that if, in fact, you have not been proven guilty, that you remain innocent. And so the idea that there should be a higher standard to prove for purposes of damages, I'm trying to wrap my head around. And I've heard it stated that it would mollify some perhaps victims with whom I regularly deal with in my other job who maybe didn't really think that the defendant or petitioner, rather, was ever innocent. But I'm not sure if I can get to that place from my location that you're innocent till proven guilty. And if you're innocent, why do you have to jump over a higher bar? And I'm sure you had expected that question, and so you know, have at it.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think that's a great question.
It's
and
true.
Certainly people are presumed innocent until proven guilty. But in this context, and the context that I know that Pete Orpik would also talk about, we see a situation that happens. There are criminal charges brought. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to recognize that gray area. What we're talking about here is somebody that was convicted actually by a jury based upon the evidence that was presented at a trial, and we're talking about people that were it was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, there are situations where, because of the newly discovered evidence, that could change everything, right? But there are also other situations that I think that are gray that I think to have the imprimatur of that the person is actually innocent because certain criteria were not met or were met under the exoneration provisions, that I'm not sure that this body, this legislature, would want to have to say that that person's innocent or to make the standard so low that it could be done in the context of the fact that the situation is truly going to be a gray one.
Mr. Orpik?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been some cases, and I know Mr. Chair is familiar, and perhaps other committee members, where a case gets reversed for a myriad reasons, and we don't have any victims or witnesses. I've had it happen where they've been deported. And the person was convicted at trial, and not technical reasons, but valid reasons that the courts may reverse it, directing us to retry it. We can't. That doesn't necessarily suggest a person's innocence. And if you make it, my concern is if it's very easy to do, it may invite some malfeasance on behalf of folks. I know that was addressed in here about witness tampering or perjury and that kind of stuff, but my concern is I've gotten witnesses that I couldn't possibly retry the case because they're gone. They've been deported. They die on us, and that causes me some concern. So I just didn't want this to be something that can be easily sought.
Mr. Orpitt, you also have cases, don't you, where witnesses die or are deported or become unavailable before you even have the chance to charge it in the first place. Isn't that true?
That is true, and you're right, sir. You're right, Mr. Chair. That's I won't suggest that the person's innocent, but I'll suggest I can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Are there questions from members? Okay. Well, Representative Metza.
Sorry for moving the mic. You could hear all the whispering before. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess kind of what I was wondering, and for whoever wants to take a stab at it, going back to the cost for getting back into society, if someone's been exonerated, I guess I'm wondering why we wouldn't try to figure something out here to make sure that when these folks are getting back out into the community that they do have the wherewithal. I know I've had friends who have come in situations where, not necessarily through exoneration, but from their sentence expiring, where when you're poor and hungry, it's, you know, leads you to make maybe decisions you wouldn't otherwise. And I think it is the state's obligation, especially in these circumstances, to provide something to deter a bad decision from getting made, so at least a person could get out there and attempt to get back out on their own and become a productive member of society versus being forced to make a decision because of their finances.
Mr. Orpitt?
I share that view, sir. I do. I've seen it. I don't know if we do enough for reentry for those who are exonerated or even those who have done their time. I've been concerned about it. I think our Department of Corrections has great concern about reentry services. I know you legislators have addressed it, but I share your concerns too. Sometimes it looks to me like we put them on a hamster wheel and we set them up to go commit more crimes when we can't get them employed. That is a concern I think all of us prosecutors share.
Representative Metza?
Senator Latz, to that point, what Representative Metza is raising is a valid consideration, but I think you'd be in a position where you'd have to have the Department of Corrections or someone provide money up front as the person's being released, which does have a direct fiscal impact that we're not funding in the bill. The compensation scheme that's set up here is somewhat after the fact, and it may come a little bit too late to go out and rent an apartment right away, but hopefully at least it would help ease the situation when they get around to that point, can get some reimbursement.
And Representative Metza?
To that point, ditto on that. I guess could we, I don't know, this is my second conference committee and kind of learning the process here. So in that, could we maybe take some of the language and look at, in the future, having them come back to us with a recommendation in this language versus an actual fiscal note and putting something in place and having a recommendation come out in the next year or two?
Senator Latz?
Well, we can certainly, Mr. Chairman, we certainly can accept recommendations. The challenge is that we don't know for sure when they're actually released from custody whether or not they are going to qualify or be eligible for that kind of transitional assistance until they've gone through the process. So I don't know how you bridge that gap. I acknowledge it's an issue, but I don't know how you bridge that gap without providing more transitional assistance to everyone who gets released. And frankly, that might be something to look at, because we do want people, whether they're released as exonerees or they're released after having served their time, we want them to successfully reintegrate and not come back into the prison system again. And that's a bigger question that we should be looking at. I know the Department of Corrections would like to be able to do more in that regard. A lot of us would like to be able to do more there. And maybe next year in a budget session, we'd be in a better position to look at that question a little more closely.
Members, we have this room a little while longer. We also have this room tomorrow at 1 o'clock. I know for myself, I'd like a little bit more time to digest what has been stated here. But I would also note, just for the record, my desire to have the language difference in here so that we have a conference committee. And that's this. This bill, as folks know, was rolling forward with popular support, as it was on in both houses on both sides of the aisle. And there would have been a tendency, I think, to just pass it and ask no questions. The county attorneys brought forth some concerns that, quite frankly, from a political perspective, would have been easy to ignore just because of the popularity of the bill. But I thought that they raised some good points that ought to be considered. And also, I think that Minnesota operates in a political way much differently than many of the other states that I've seen, state legislatures. And the value of having buy-in from folks, even folks or groups who would otherwise be bulldozed on any one issue or bill, that value is immense. And so I want to commend both sides for coming to the place that you did. I'm very impressed. The Innocence Project, from their perspective, honestly, probably didn't need to entertain changes. Okay. And you've done, like you said, Ms. Jonas and Mr. Hansen and Ms. Emerson and all the folks sitting behind you, you've been to a lot of hearings and you've done a lot of work on this. So acceding to the request to do a little bit more when you didn't have to, I think it speaks volumes for your integrity with respect to the process. On the side of the county attorneys, it was really difficult to come to a place on this bill where you could even talk about potentially compromising, because there were folks in your organization who objected soundly to many of the provisions. But you did it anyway. You came a long way in compromising, and I in turn am impressed with that. So thank you for presenting us a picture of really how bills should be done up here at the Capitol in this kind of session. With that, I know that I don't have any other questions for you. I don't know if other members of the committee do. At this point, it's my intention to recess and have conversations also with each other and individuals about how we're going to approach this. But with that, I'd entertain the first comment from Mr. Choi and then comments from any others before we go into recess. Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chair, maybe if it's your direction and the direction of this committee, sometimes things aren't always just one way or the other way. Perhaps there's still more opportunity to have some discussion for compromise. I'm not sure exactly how that could be worked out, but if the Innocence Project is willing to think about some things, maybe, I don't know how long you're going to recess until tomorrow or whatever it is, maybe we could, if you give us that direction and that encouragement, and if it's something that you'd like us to do, I think that that might make for a good policy decision, potentially. I don't know. Maybe not.
Well, Mr. Choi, you've always been good at finding the compromise in variant positions. I don't know, because these are two legal standards that are just a fundamental disagreement between the two. But you're probably smarter than me.
Well, Mr. Chair, but just as an example, I mean, maybe the standard could be different for certain situations. Because that's the heartburn for our association, is that those gray situations, the ones that are relatively obvious and where the person is innocent without question, we don't want to stand in the way of that. And one of the reasons why we wanted to be a part of the petition process is because our role as prosecutors is not just merely to convict people and then be done with it. I mean, the reality is that from our role as ministers of justice is to do the right thing. And so, and I really appreciate the fact that the Innocence Project allowed us to have that process where we could participate and do that. And I'd like to encourage all of my colleagues around the state, when that moment comes, that we would do the right thing. What really gives us some where we're frightened, quite frankly, is that the situation where we just have that gray situation where we truly believe that this person is not innocent and has committed a horrible crime, but because of certain things that could be, I guess, contemplated to say that that might have been consistent with innocence, and that was it, the decision was reversed, but we just don't we can't try the case again because, as County Attorney Orpik talked about, because of lack of evidence, we can't actually ethically proceed. Even if we in our heart believe that someone is guilty, it is unethical for us to proceed to charge someone with a crime if we cannot prove that case beyond a reasonable doubt, and so we can't. And then there are situations that where we have a victim who is begging us, pleading with us not to try the case again because they've moved on in their life. In fact, we have a case right now where we have a sexual assault victim, and she's married and moved on. And she does not want us to have another trial. And so those are the things that we – and I don't want to change behavior because I want to make sure that prosecutors also recognize those victim situations as well. And so – so maybe there's a way to think about it in the context of when clear and convincing would apply and when preponderance would apply.
So, and I appreciate that statement, Mr. Choi. As you know, as I go forward from here to the table, and just some members know, it's my intention to adjourn. We've got this room tomorrow at 1 o'clock, at which point the Senate will have the gavel. But in my mind, it's my decision to leave here personally and decide which way I want to go on the standard of how I'll decide tomorrow. If you can come up with some kind of creative middle way, I absolutely encourage you to do that, and will be even more impressed than I have been with both sides coming together on this. So thank you for that. Any other comments from members of the conference committee before we adjourn?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts.
I won't repeat, but I will echo what you said about the role and that the parties have played and the stakeholders have, and they're working together and coming forward in good faith to find what we have, I think, in front of us, a very good bill. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Letts. The conference committee is adjourned.